Welcome to the Artist Mother Podcast, featuring interviews with incredible working artists who are also mothers and compelling conversations regarding parenting and the art world. These conversations create a space for inclusivity and support for artist mothers worldwide. I'm Kaylin Butine, painter, mom of three, and podcast host. I'm so grateful you are tuning in, and I hope you enjoy this episode.
We had to mentor each other, any of the women that were in school at that point. There was no role model. We were learning, and there was a beautiful camaraderie, which my entire life I have kept. And I think one of the hardest things about being old is so many dying, that I've seen, that I've been close to. But from undergraduate days on, I connected to other women artists, and I have my whole life, and I've formed groups and whatever it is.
Helen Redman is a widely exhibited figurative painter, teacher, feminist commentator, and grandmother who shares her art in the context of life issues. She has taught at the University of Colorado and the University of Iowa, and has lectured and exhibited her art across the United States. She's been an active force for gaining support and recognition for women in the arts, co-founding Front Rage Women in the Visual Arts in Boulder, Colorado in the 1970s, and serving as the first president of the San Diego's Women's Caucus for the Arts in the 1990s. For over six decades, her work has centered on her life passages, including pregnancy, mothering, illness, healing, and the death of a child, and on various stages of her children's growth. Helen, who was born in the 1940s, has focused in recent years on exploring women's journeys through menopause and old age and contradicting the negativity provoked by aging in a sexist and youth-oriented culture. It is such an honor to welcome Helen to the Artist Mother podcast. And we will actually be sharing her story in two episodes to break it up. So be sure to tune in next week for part two. Helen will be joined in conversation with her daughter, Nicole Barchelon Frank, a maker, death doula, and healer. So let's dive in. Welcome Helen Redman and daughter, Nicole. Helen, I'm just thrilled to share in conversation with you, and just can't thank you enough for being here. So let's kick things off by having you share something about your childhood that you feel like connects to your life as an artist today. I'm curious to know if you feel like you were always meant to be an artist, or if kind of being an artist was something that you dreamed of when you were a kid.
I did not dream of it as a kid. It was my sister who was the artist, 5.5 years older than me, Jean. I grew up in it wouldn't have been something I could envision. I was a poor second generation immigrant kid, and in of all places, Miami Beach, Florida.
Really?
Yes. Not in the high end glitzy, but it was to become that. South Beach, it was before the whole Art Deco restoration. But I grew up in this little part, it's an island between the beach and the ocean and the bay. And there were three of us, all 5.5 years apart. My mother would walk us to the beach almost every day, because even though we didn't have many resources, we had the ocean. And
what a great resource.
I mentioned that because from a very early age, I was always seeing people, you know, in beach culture, which is, you know, not dressed much and cavorting and moving, a very dynamic, colorful kind of.
And Miami Beach culture at that. We're not talking Miami Nantucket here. Yeah. We're talking Miami.
Right. Miami Beach is just off the charts. It always has been. It's a different kind of off the charts right now. It's more international, but, you know, it was also, it has a very dark underbelly. It always has. And when I grew up, it was a segregated island. I was very conscious of that. there were just many difficulties. And I just want to mention the other very colorful thing about my background, since my art is so colorful, is that my father was a carnival man.
Really?
Yeah. And when they had the first child, Jean, they were still able to travel and do things. But then when I came along, he wanted to try and, I won't say the word settle, because we were never settled. It was a very unstable life. And it was a boom or bust kind of situation constantly. And he was, he had a lot of challenges. Anyway, my mother held us together, but I mentioned that it's just a different upbringing. Yeah. The East Coast or anything like that. So it was unconventional from the start.
Yeah. Were you kind of involved in the carnival culture then, or was that?
No, that was, he had left that, but my father then became like a press agent in the days. My father never, he left school, I think, in fourth grade. He wasn't very well educated. As publicity became a very educated field, he really didn't have a place. But before that, he traveled from town to town promoting movies, and, you know, it was a whole different way of life. And he was always a very crazy character, doing new things all the time. And he was very involved with newspaper men all the time, too. So there were colorful characters all around our life, but I never actually lived that part of the life that was when he was a carny man. But his personality was carny man, and his, you know. Anyway,
so do you remember, you know, spending time painting or drawing, coloring, like as a kid,
Yeah, let me mention some of that. That my sister said to me that she was always the one that recalled everything and knew everything, not me. But she said, as a child, I would pick up my mother's razor blade, because my mother was always sewing and cutting things with that. And that I began cutting out shapes. Mm. My mother used to patch all the clothes in odd ways, you know, very fanciful. And my sister, as I said, she was much earlier the artist, and they were teaching art in school. So we were exposed to art through school. And also my sister, who later became a librarian, told me that it was libraries that my mother, that was another thing that was free. You could go to the library and look at books there, and that there were art shows. So she claims that had a lot to do with how we were art aware, but I had no museum or gallery culture or any of that until I went to college.
You had library culture and beach and beach culture.
Library, like, and beach
amazing
culture.
Amazing cultures.
Yes.
But I think it's just a few things too. There was a lot of difficult things to sort of escape from, and the beach and the library were refuges, you know, sanctuaries for my mom and her family, or her siblings. And also, I didn't know that about Grandma Isabel repairing things in a funny way. And if you look at any of my clothing, like almost every piece of clothing that I have sewn an interesting or strange patch on. I don't repair clothes in a normal way. And I didn't know that about Grandma Isabel. So that has been passed on despite not knowing it. So it's just funny when you said that, Mom.
Yeah. And my sister and I, she died 5.5 years ago, but all our life we exchanged collages and we also had a very humorous take on life, my sister and I. And
were you close?
5.5 years apart, but we weren't close in the sense of physically close, because she went off to work early after graduating high school. And I left and went to Colorado when I was 20 years old. So we were physically apart, but we always kept some kind of touch.
Yeah.
And my whole family has that distended whatever. You know, family was a hard thing to keep together. We didn't live close by.
Okay, Helen, so we're gonna dig into so much of your story, but I always like to have folks describe their art, just so as listeners are kind of listening to you talk and hearing about your journey, they can kind of have a mental picture of, you know, some of your paintings or your work sort of in their head, with the assumption that they may have not seen your work before. So can you describe your art? I know it's hard to describe, you know, such a long life of creating, but what are some of kind of the basic things that you feel like sort of encapsulate the work that you make, and what are some of the main mediums that you use?
The core of my work is always about the human condition. No matter what I'm doing, whatever media style, scale, and there's been so many, you feel a personality, you feel a presence. And I'm always exploring people and connecting to people. You know, I mentioned that thing with my mother doing the patching and the collage and the cutting and the things and the color. So pattern and color have been strong in my work for over six decades. So that would be one key thing you're always going to see. Even if I'm doing a head-on portrait staring at you, there will be patterns or textures that are telling you about the person. It isn't just as powerful as gesture is to me, or line or contour, or, you know, those things to describe a person. There's also like a symbolic level of narration going on throughout.
So yeah, I just want to add, like in all of the portraits that my mother has done of my brother and I, almost, I can't think of one for my childhood, almost every portrait for many years had my quilt that was made by another artist, Radka Donnell, baby quilt. And that quilt shows up in my, you know, portrait when I'm four, and my portrait when I'm seven, and my portrait when I'm 12, you know, in the portrait that's now hanging in the Boston Museum of me pregnant with my daughter, the pattern is that quilt. And so there is a thread of continuity that, because she knows me and she's been painting me since before I was born, that includes pattern and quilt, because those are part of our lives, right? We don't exist separate from our environments. And so my mother brings the environment to her work with all the portraits she's done, and then with the work she's doing now, which isn't specifically about, you know, individual people, but it's sort of the backdrop, almost the quilt of our communities or the quilt of our lives right now. What is actually going on, and in our culture, and the good, the bad, and the ugly are all there.
Yes.
I thought of one more thing I wanted to tell you, is that I once I went through all the, oh, maybe I'm going out of sequence here, the life drawing. Yeah, we're going to go to university, but that I tend to work in series, that I'm investigating or exploring something. And you see a number of them on the website, although there were too many to put up there. But I stay with a topic very intensely. I study it in many ways, from reading about it to, you know, I may take pictures. I do different kinds of research, particularly when I came into the whole issue about aging, menopause and aging, enormous research behind these very expressive portraits and reading what other people had said. And so anyway, a series can go on like lifelines. It can go on almost a lifetime, or it can be a year. But that's... you know, grasping something. I try to grasp something from its surface through every part that I can grasp.
Yeah. And I think that's helpful in understanding the context of just the way that you work, and, you know, knowing that you're kind of a series-based artist, you really dig deep once you decide to pick a topic that you're going to go on, and it might, you know, just the longevity of that might range, but yeah, I think it's helpful for understanding your practice. Okay, Helen. So now that folks kind of have that image in your mind, in their minds, just wanting to go back a little bit. You mentioned you were brought up in Miami, and then you moved away to Colorado to go to school, or to go to Colorado? Kind of take me on a journey a little bit about like what happened sort of after you left Miami. Where did you find yourself?
After graduating from the university in Miami, which I did in 3 years, I've never understood what my hurry was, but it was, I was always intensely moving through something. But I had started taking some summer classes at the University of Colorado. And yeah, I was, I think, a server, and they used to have French, like I was, what do you call it? Like the French house, or you would speak at the French table, the Spanish table. I don't mm-hmm. know if anybody ever does any of this anymore, but.
Yeah. Yeah. Like clubs or something.
And it was work study too, right, Mom? Was it
yeah,
also?
But that was different. But what I'm talking about, how I met your dad, was because to earn my way to be in the dorm, I was a server, you know, food, and we would serve the tables. And he was at a table where he would be they would speak French at his table.
Okay. So, like for a language course.
But it wasn't he was a French teacher, but it wasn't the teaching. It was the, you were eating and you were being served and spoken to in French.
Yeah.
I don't know.
What I think like a French club, like you meet with your club and you're supposed to talk about, or you're supposed to talk in French. Like if you were in drama club, you would.
Yeah, I guess. But it was centered around food.
Okay.
So, I don't know why that's
it important. Sounds great.
Yeah, I don't know, but it's because I was slopping up the hash and doing things like that, you know.
And you're like, oh, who's this cute guy speaking in French?
No,
he was much older.
He was much older, and I was noticing this other French guy, tall and fantastic, but my husband made the move really fast.
Okay, okay. Like,
without getting into that, we had connected. And then I had to go back to finish my degree for the year. But as soon as the minute I graduated, I came to Colorado, and in a short time we were married.
And this is in the 60s,
mm-hmm.
right? I think it's important to reference sort of the decade, just so folks understand. You were born in the 40s.
And I married in 1960.
Yeah.
Yeah. You were 20.
Yeah, in that summer. Yeah. Yep. And we lived in a small, Boulder then was a small campus town, and mm-hmm. Our life was very university connected. I guess you would call me a faculty wife.
Yeah.
Which gave me the benefits of being able to go to school. So I then, I was at that point going to be an art teacher. And
so did you study art in Miami in university?
Oh, yes.
When you were there?
Yes.
Okay.
The University of Miami was where I had my first undergraduate classes. And I also, actually my major was into history and then art history. So I was very interested in the history of things, but I didn't ever think, what is that word Nicole used, a maker? I didn't conceive of myself as a maker, but the more studio classes I took, the more engaged I got. Mm-hmm. But you know, I had to have a practical focus, like teaching art or something, mm-hmm. so I could earn a living. And so when I got, so in Colorado, I interned as a substitute. I interned both in junior high and high school. And I remember the intensity of taking like a painting or drawing class at the university, where I was totally in myself doing it. And
mm-hmm.
and then what it was to teach. And it felt like I was a great teacher, but it felt like every bit of my creativity was being poured into the situation of teaching. And somehow when I got involved with life drawing, I just grabbed it for myself. I just really grabbed it and haven't left it for over 60 years. But I wanted to tell you that I know when we talk about the 60s, it's a you know, we're still in an era that's all male dominated and white male dominated and all the whole, I don't need to go into all that stuff. But I, oddly enough, the main two main professors, men, influenced my life enormously, were incredibly nurturing and supportive of women. Hmm. And one was quite spiritual in his approach and meditative, which is another avenue I didn't even understand at the time. But later in my life, that was also to develop so much. But almost a very Zen presence in how mm-hmm. he taught. And he really got us going. He got me to do contour drawing, which became, I don't know why, but that line, that sense of touching, actually touching. That's another thing. My art is just touchy. Mm-hmm. You know? That gave me an avenue or something came through about that. So I would say that media and it is so critical in freeing who or developing who you're, how you get your form through, mm-hmm. how, you know, I'm not finding the words, but, in any case, this other teacher, Roland Reese, he really, he treated men and women totally equally in a time when nobody else was. He was totally encouraging. And if anything, it was so supportive and dynamic. You know, we would get our studios after we graduated. We were to enter every exhibition. We were to, I mean, what? There was just so many things. We were all... And it was just a very, very rigorous and exciting time. And he drew alongside us. Mm. And I had other incredible classmates. We were, it was just a very live dynamic. And I had been very, what is it, solitary. I mean, I didn't really have many friends. I was, I had, you know, I knew I had to get out of Miami Beach. I really mm-hmm. got that early in life. But I found my connection or my path in art school on the graduate level, really. And I'm very grateful to these men that, including my husband at mm-hmm. the time, who were not sexist in their approach, who opened doors that were really closed for so many people at that time.
Were you the only female artist in your program?
No, I was not, but there were several women. It, you know, actually, when I first started at the University of Colorado, there were women teaching, but in no time at all, I don't know, they disappeared or whatever happened. Hmm. And the University of Colorado, you know, the West was actually better for a lot of things. Mm-hmm. There were early pioneers in that field. They were out drawing in the mountains. You know, Colorado is a very independent place with women, very powerful women. Mm-hmm. Some of those women were teachers, but by the time I was there, they were older or retiring or just so. And a whole new batch came in, and then they were all men. Mm-hmm. And then there were no women teachers at all for a really long time till in the 70s we began when I helped form Front Range Women in the Visual Arts. It grew out of the University of Colorado, and we joined with the graduate students there who were, you know, really hammering for affirmative action, for having teachers, for all kinds of things. By the way, when I was in grad school, so many, you asked about some of the other women people. Mm-hmm. I part of how people were able to do it was they got teaching. What do you call it? Associates. You know, you could.
You were being a TA, a teacher's assistant.
Yeah, teacher's assistant. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you got to teach classes, but you weren't, you know, you had one class or something that helped you to. Mm-hmm. So I was not permitted to do that because I was a faculty wife and there were nepotism laws at the University of Colorado. And I used to listen to them talking about the women in the French department, you know, like, oh, the graduate students, you know, Madame was so much better than Monsieur, and you know, it was a husband, wife, and what to do, and you know, so it was. I can't remember when they finally changed that, but it took a while to. Mm-hmm. You know, so I don't know how I got off on that one, but
Anything else you want to share about just, I don't know, the powerful position you were in of being, you know, a female MFA student in the 60s? Like that just, I still think even though you weren't the only one in your program, like there were not many, many, many of you, you know, in the United States at the time. So just anything else you want to share about that?
Yeah, experience? Well, just to share that when it really where what you're saying came into play is when I had a child, because that was in the last year of school. I think there was really starting to be an interest in women and their, you know, what they were doing, because, you know, abstract expressionism had come in and there
the
were
the Joan Mitchells and Lee Krasner,
mainly men and everything. There was still the more sensitive men, and there were many, or we wouldn't be here probably, but along with all of us that fought for it. It's so interesting that you think of it as powerful. I didn't, it was, I guess it was. I wanted to say that we didn't have role models. Mm-hmm. I mean, you couldn't find, you know, again, the books were all male, everything. Although I was aware of Katie Kollwitz, and that was important to me. And I used to work with a slide library, was part of how I earned money. I also was a model myself. Mm. So the life and the whole interaction was, you know, very integrated, very full, very rich. But the other, we had to mentor each other, any of the women that were in school at that point. There was no role model. Mm-hmm. We were learning, and there was a beautiful camaraderie, which my entire life I have kept. And I think one of the hardest things about being old is so many dying, so many dying that I've seen, that I've been close to. But from undergraduate days on, I connected to other women artists, and I have my whole life, and I've formed groups and whatever it is. But
Women artists supporting women artists is just kind of everything.
Very important.
And it just, I don't know, I just got chills when you said that, because it's still true today, you know. And I hope that we always recognize the power in supporting each other, you know.
Yeah. And what did you make me think of when you
said the non-competitiveness as that it's not that there's a sisterhood, that there's a relationship of support and care that is really different from traditional models of how to get ahead. Like that the women, you know, are advocating for each other and themselves together, not just, oh, my art is the most important. Like, yes, but that we're doing it, like, even to form groups, to say Front Range Women in the Arts, like there's a group of us, you know, and, you know, we want to be represented.
And that community building hopefully changes culture, right?
It does. I've seen it change culture, but it is, you know, I always think of a revolution is really an evolution. You're working on it all the time. You know, what we're seeing now, sometimes I'm just completely despairing with, and frightened for where things are moving on every level in our culture, but certainly for women after having worked for so many things. And I want to say too that you were talking about powerful. Yes, I was imbued with a power to be an artist, and I was being treated like a man, but, you know, I had a baby. And that sort of rocked the boat. It's like, how exactly do you emulate that white male model?
Do you remember showing up to art classes like pregnant?
I remember hiding it for quite some time. You know, I'm tall, and I could just wear sloppy kinds of things. Yes, let's see. I a lot of it's a blur, I have to say, because we're coming to the really hard part of what I have to talk about.
Well, and Paula was born in May, so that her August. Paula was born in August.
No, sorry. I had to go right back to school, Nicole.
Right, but you had the summer when you were the most pregnant.
Oh, right.
You were in the last few months when she was born, because she was born in August. And right. so that meant that, you know, there was this little window, you know, you mm-hmm. finished the term and then you had that window of the summer.
She's got it.
Okay. So I am interested in this though, Helen, just because I had a child while I was in my graduate program as well. I took a semester off, had my daughter, and then came back, and I think I had one semester left. So like did the final thesis
with the baby.
Or no, she at my thesis show, I think she was a year old. So I must have kind of had her in the middle of my program, but I did take a semester off. So yeah, just, I don't know, like hearing kind of that part of your story, like not putting those, like just continuing on with life and still doing your education, still doing your art, like kind of moving through. I don't know, that just is really inspiring to me.
You know, I remember you asked a question like pragmatically, how did I do it? Which like, God, how did I do it? We had babysitters in the university community, like the French students and some of the art students. Even later in life, somebody would come up to me and say they babysat for mm-hmm. me. You know, and I thought, oh, you know, no memory, no idea of it. But, you know, and then I think they had to be potty trained and then they could go to nursery school. So I didn't take them to class. I certainly was not in the class nursing them, although I know that's a whole different thing today. And it was, I don't remember how, you know, we lived close to the campus. I could get over there. I rode my bike and do my stuff there. And I think we also had some individual studios at that time, shacks that we were in. So, and then I was always working either on the table or the basement or the whatever I was, mm-hmm. and I was drawing inside and outside of class because it was such an intense life drawing time and painting time. And I was researching a thesis too during that. Mm. So anyway.
So you had Paula in the summer and then you had one full year left of your graduate program and you graduated in the spring.
Yeah, must have been. Yeah. Yeah, in 63. So, and just around that time, I want to say, wow, I shot out of grad school like a cannon or something. I mean, things were going incredibly well, better than, you know, anything else to later. There was an interest in the work I was doing. It was so bold. And I think people didn't think of women as being that bold and the subject matter and the, you know, the approach, whatever it was, there were curators paying attention to me. And I had entered a painting in a show, when we go to the images, I'll show you. The very first show I entered was an Intermountain Biennial of Painting and Sculpture in 1963, and it was at the Salt Lake Art Center. And, you know, I just expected rejection. We all understood you had to send your paintings off. We had to crate things. I did enormous pieces. It was ridiculous. Anyway, all of a sudden, it turns out, I have won the Jurors Award, a purchase prize, mind you, a purchase prize. I barely ever sell anything, but... and then that painting was part of what they did was they were donating to museums in the Intermountain area. Mm. And they asked me to name one. And the only one I even knew was the Colorado Springs Fine Arts Center. And they, to this day, have that painting. And I actually got to see it hanging. I didn't even know. That's a whole story. I won't go into that, but, you know,
what a boost though, to be fresh out of grad school and to have sort of, you know, cause yeah. a lot of people experience a big block after they get out of grad school and it can be a really hard time. So just to kind of have that, support immediately, I'm sure was encouraging.
Very encouraging. And I was even beginning to show with my professors. Mm. And so that was, I had my first solo shows, a lot of group shows. And then the director of the Salt Lake Art Center at the time, the chief curator, he became really got really into my work, he'd first seen it in that Intermountain show, and he was offering me a solo museum show. It offered me, I mean, arranged it. It was happening. And so that's where we get into tough waters now.
Do you want me to tell the story, Mom? And you
interrupt? Well, I just have this line here. He invited me to begin their 1964-65 season with what was then called a one-man exhibit. I have to add that, the one-man exhibit.
So I was going to say, one-man exhibit, Helen Redman.
Right. You know, or they would say Mrs. Helen Barshall. And sometimes they said Mrs. Shock Barshall. It was, you know, it was really great. That was
how Redman's her maiden name, quote, maiden name. You know, that was her father's.
I went back to that.
Yeah. So later, she went back to Redman, but Barshall was.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. So let's see. Well, what I'm trying to say here is it was an extraordinary time. Mm-hmm. And like you say, an unusual time. And even for a man or a woman to come out of graduate school and to have that kind of interest in their work. Mm-hmm. And then what happened was 5 months into my pregnancy with Nicole, my daughter right there, I lost my first daughter, Paula. She was 20 months of age. Her death is still to this day mysterious, an unexplained infection or whatever it was, a misdiagnosis with a doctor. I was a young, really, I didn't know anything about mothering. It was an era when whatever the doctor said, he trusted. The doctor knew best. The doctor knew best about her birth. You didn't even get to birth your baby. That was their thing. They birthed the baby, you know. So it was very sudden and devastating. And that same doctor who I've had to work so much on forgiveness, to him, on myself. These are, you know, these kinds of things impact your whole life. What am I saying? Oh, he immediately, you know, in this whole crazed thing of being in the hospital or the emergency room, she was already dead in her bed that morning, her crib, but there was still a lot of, you know, intense drama of, so he immediately turned to me, and I think he was really covering his tracks. He told me it was crib death and that it was not crib death. That was not, you know, that was, but he went on to say he'd lost a child even much older from crib death. So he immediately, you know, did something in that situation. I was in total shock anyway. And then he said, you have to be really careful now or you'll lose this child. So I was faced with, see, even telling you that I can feel that I was faced with, I can't just howl and grieve. And, whatever it was, cause I felt like a death mother and I'm liable to kill this other child. I mean, it was very, very, heavy and intense. And, you know, I even had to go back in the next few weeks and pack up the show that was going to the Salt Lake Arts Center. And fortunately, my professor who had helped me so much with the life drawing, he came and helped me to do that. Because I don't know how I did anything that I did. But we also, at that time, my husband was a fairy tale, all his life was a fairy tale scholar. And he was always doing research at the Bibliothèque Nationale in Paris because it was French fairy tales were one of his specialties along with Complet and things like that. And I think we just had to get out of that house where she died at home. And he got a, whatever you call it, a research grant or something to go to Paris. So we left that summer. I'm not sure what the dates were. I think.
Well, Paula died in May 16th.
Yeah.
And if you went in the summer, that would have probably been within a month or so that you were in Paris by then.
Well, at least by July, we were there. And I think some French student at Jacques had helped us to find a little apartment, something. I really, the details, I don't know. But whatever it was, I also had learned from another friend, this is women to women too, how you change the world, who talked to me about natural childbirth. I'd had a ridiculous experience with Paula, you know, where they anesthetized you. There wasn't even any reason they had to, but and induced her labor so I could get back to school. I mean, just stuff I would, you know, it was so ignorant. I was so ignorant at the time. So she was encouraging me to learn about natural childbirth. And when I was going to go to France, she told me all about Lamaze. And sure enough, the Cartier Hospital there was using Lamaze natural childbirth.
And the French.
God love them. way ahead of the curve on what they were doing. So I was very, I was studying these booklets and doing the breath work and learning, you know, how to do that. And I began, I was all alone in this apartment, and I, you know, got French oil pastels, which thank God they were French, because that's what all these things are in the Boston Museum now. They
high quality.
Yes. The paper was high quality, because I always worked on cheap paper. I was just too nervous to ever do anything else. But, you know, I got these papers and the oil crayon. And I remember oil crayon was just the right thing, because it was so emotional and greasy and you couldn't change it. I mean, it was just, I was just making marks and coloring in this intense way. But I always began by looking at myself. I don't know what, I must've found a mirror somewhere. I was on some tape. I don't even know physically how I created these. And I would say the last 6 or 7 weeks, when you're usually in pregnancy, so laid out and heavy, and you know, it's really not a time that you have the kind of vigor to do the artwork that I did, but I was just obsessed and compelled. And I think that was really the only way it was a form of grieving, but it was also really, I didn't know these words, a visualization. It was a critical form of visualization for my child to be well, to be born well, you know, in the head down position, very aware of all these things. And, you know,
you were mostly drawing portraits of yourself pregnant with Nicole at that time, and kind of
portraits,
focusing on the healthy baby, but still having the physical experience of the grief that you were going through, and maybe not literally depicting that yet in your work, but you know, of course, still. I mean, art is your language, right? So,
thank God. That is such a gift and such a blessing. And I think that, you know, art is action in itself, or activism in itself. And what you give off in your art speaks to other people that can read it. It is a language, you know? So, and I think you, if you really look at that series, you probably can see that there's death there. It's just like now when I'm watching a movie or something, I say, oh, a child has died. You know, there's just something I know, like a radar that comes in about that. That so whatever it was, I did that. I had a great birth. Well, we had a quick birth or something with her. And I was, you know, you were supposed to do the controlled breathing and all that. And I think, and you were, I remember I screamed when she was born, or I maybe didn't control everything properly. And then I remember it was all in French. I barely spoke French, but it was something like "Elle a crié." You know, it was like I did something wrong. I screamed. But, you know, who cared at that point? She was. I had this fabulous new baby. And one other thing I want to say that I remember is that they put the babies at your feet in we were in a overall ward, like and you know, where they take the babies away, or did in the United States, and you, whatever it was, you know, they brought them to you, and you had them in there. They were off in their nurseries or whatever it was. So right next to me was a Black woman from Martinique, and she picked her baby up and she just kissing it, you know, hugging it, loving it. I said, oh, you know, I can do that. Like, so it sort of was, I had a new permission there. There was a new way to do this. Nicole was brought in and she really brought the color back into our life, because everything really was, you know, it was pretty difficult for both Jacques and I. And we were very isolated. We did not have family close to us or friends or anybody around. I mean, it was, we should probably jump to Nicole now. I don't know.
No. I got a couple more questions for this time period, Helen.
Take a breath, Mom. Just take a deep breath.
This is amazing. You're knocking it out of the park. Okay. I'm on the edge of my seat, holding on to every word. Artist mothers know there's nothing more important than taking care of yourself, because if you're not feeling your best, you can't be your best. Sambucol helps you feel your best with powerful immune support, powered by nature's superfruit, black elderberry. I'm personally so grateful for Sambucol and their immune system supporting products. I think about my health a lot and feel like the best action I can take, besides getting good sleep, is nourishing my body by consuming healthy things that support my immune system. Sambucol elderberry gummies taste great, and I love that they are low in sugar and contain no gelatin, since my family is vegetarian. It's so easy to get my kiddos to eat one of these gummies every day, and it helps me feel good knowing my kids have the support from products like this, especially in a season of life where reinforcing our bodies with healthy things is just on our minds a lot. Sambucol is a trusted brand. It's the original black elderberry and was developed by a virologist, so I know I'm getting a great quality product. Get 15% off your next order of $9.99 or more at sambucolusa.com. Use code ARTIST15 for 15% off. Just as a note, these statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Thank you, Sambucol, for supporting the Artist Mother podcast. We so appreciate you and the products you're putting into the world. Again, Artist Mothers get 15% off your next order of $9.99 or more at sambucolusa.com and use code ARTIST15 for 15% off. The term that's coming up for me is ambivalence. And I, you know, this term for me is important because I've this year done a project on maternal ambivalence and just this idea of, you know, allowing space for multiple experiences to go on at once, right? And how capitalism, patriarchy often wants to distill us down to our simplest form so that we can be commodified. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as women and particularly as mothers, we are so complex, right? Like, we can love a child and hate a child in the same moment. Yes. And so I'm just thinking of this, you know, for you, because I mean, you literally are holding this deep grief and burying it, and you're being told by people that you're not allowed to experience it, and you need to simplify and move on. And yet, in this other hand, you do the, like, you lost a child, the most painful thing a mother can probably go through. And then you also gave birth and you created another child, like the most wonderful thing a mother can go through in the same span of, what was it, like 4 months?
Yeah. Yes, it was simultaneous. And I think that's the thing I think of about life and death. The polarity of these things has been real
I'm just wondering about if you remember, like, what you were experiencing at that time. You know, like, did you have tools to hold space for that complexity that needed to come out? Like, were you able to feel that grief and that joy simultaneously? Or, like, just how did you process?
I think it was the artwork is what I had and how I came through it. I'm just, as you say that, I can remember the feeling when I was pregnant with Nicole in Paris, and I'd be walking down the street and all of a sudden, you know, a mother would come by with her baby in the carriage and the, you know, the gasp, and, you know, suddenly, like, what's the word? I didn't want to deny her experience or be, and, you know, with, or resent it or be, but it would be like, it would strike me terribly. Why did I lose my baby here? Mm-hmm. You know, like, what? And the continual not knowing of why I lost her, you know, never having a defined category of, not that that really helps, but it does set up. In fact, there must have also been great fear about having another child, because you don't know, you know, what caused that? Will it happen to me again? Which is, of course, the most, a huge fear. I was so engaged with these things. And after Nicole was born, I was just observing her every minute. And I was so occupied. I was so busy with this. And it just seemed to...
When did the processing of Paula's death happen?
It's still happening.
Mm-hmm. Probably not until menopause, and also when I began doing some work in a grief group. So it was way, 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 way mm-hmm. later. I also want to say, we haven't mentioned Paul yet, but that I went on. We were several months in Paris, and then we had to come back to the University of Colorado in Boulder. And I was determined to get pregnant, and I did. I don't know how I could just, I listened to people with infertility things and all, but whatever it was, I was able, you know, got pregnant the third mm-hmm. time. Had my son in 15 months from the time I had Nicole. So there was 3.5 years or 3.5 years that I was childbearing. Mm-hmm. When you're in that, you're in that. That mm-hmm. you know how full that is. That mm-hmm. that, and I think both of us did that. And we had to underground the grief and the pain. It was, I'm sure, it was always there. It probably showed up in other things, but we were hyper busy raising a family, doing our mm-hmm. careers, and. You know, I don't know. I know you had at one point asked some question about the like art and maternal life or something. They were, for me, developed together.
Yeah.
There wasn't a time that I chose to have children and then I chose to do my art, or things were all mix-mashed. My life has always been very mix-mashed.
Well, Helen, I think that's a good point to have Nicole share a little bit about her experience being raised by you, just because, you know, I think I wonder, you know, my kids are 9, 5, and 3, and it's just like, look, I think of myself in the future, like, am I gonna really be able to understand like what I was doing during this period of my life and how I got things done? Like, I don't know, but maybe my kids will have a better perspective, give me some feedback. I don't know. So Nicole, just curious to have you reflect a little bit, you know, about your experience being raised by Helen as a professional artist. What was your home life like growing up? And, you know, just curious to, I don't know, have you talk about your childhood a little bit?
Well, I have to start with my sister's death because it's my first experience on this planet that I actually have a sense of, and that it was part of my life from before mm-hmm. I was born. And it's part of made me who I am. So I can't just talk about all the incredible artwork that was in our house, because while my mother was being told she couldn't experience or process her grief, it was still happening. And it was happening in her womb. It was happening with me. There was a transition between when Paula came in and left and when I came in. And we sort of had this moment of crossing when she left. And I was conscious of that from before I was born. And so she was always present for me my whole life. Less now, but since my dad died, you know, but she'll be there for mom when mm-hmm. mom leaves, hopefully a long time from now. But I can't talk about my childhood or my life without Paula in it, even though she wasn't in a body anymore.
I'm just curious, this might be a personal question, but just how was the narrative of Paula shared with you, and how was her life celebrated in your home?
It wasn't with my mom, other than, you know, these portraits, but it wasn't something we talked about. My dad would take me to the cemetery on a regular basis, and I was drawn to the cemetery where her grave was because I felt very connected there. And I still, you know, I'm Jewish, and I work with what's called the Hever Kadisha, the Jewish Burial Society. And I actually started visiting the graveyard when I was a little girl, and putting, you know, people would be desecrating it, and I would be trying to pick up gravestones and put them back where they belonged. You know, I just always had a consciousness about death mm-hmm. and the dying that was different. So that was one side of my life, and it was unspoken, even with my father taking me to the cemetery. It wasn't something we ever talked about. It was a silent testament, you know, and an artistic testament, because her grave was an artistic sculpture, and it was the most beautiful, really beautiful, calm, incredible place. And I felt very at peace there. Our home was always full of color. My mother's studio was in the backyard, you know, so we were, you know, we would be in school or go at the library, and then we'd be in the studio. And, mm-hmm. you know, if she was painting somebody, okay, we weren't supposed to be in there. But most of the time, you know, there's pictures of us with, you know, old shirts, and we're painting, my brother mm-hmm. and I, you know, next to her, you know, like she's painting and we're painting, you know, and we were both, my brother and I, extremely artistic, very, very different. Like, you know, he's more the pattern and the lines and the geometry. And I'm like this wild thing. So no. And, you know, flowers and, you know, sort of colors and things. So, and mixed matched patches, but our home, every surface in our home was colored. Like almost every door was painted. My dresser, I still miss this dresser. I don't remember if it even exists anymore. Is it at your house, or did we get rid of it, Mom?
I think it's finally gone.
Yeah. I mean, every space in the house, every wall, every door, even in the hallway, the pattern of the carpet was like these colored tiles that were different colored tiles. There just wasn't anywhere in the house that wasn't colorful. And it was kind of incredible for people to come to our home. And there was, you know, there were strange sculptures, because my mother was also buying art from other, I mean, they were sharing, they were
trading,
art
trades. Trading,
not buying, right, trading. Support, right? Mutual support. So our house on Arapaho had these, I mean, I still remember these like ceramic, they were pretty phallic, these sort of ceramic things coming out of the ground, you know, these, and then there was, you know, metal sculptures. I mean, there was a sun that my mother painted, or, you know, on the front, you know, the house was just colorful. And that color is huge for me. So I, you know, what I can say is that there was an unspoken, unacknowledged presence in my life. And it wasn't just Paula. It was my whole relationship with the divine and with angels. And she wasn't the only one in my life that way, but she was the first. And that was never talked about. And it wasn't until I got much older that I could start to share that and bring that out. And neither of my parents were religious. We were Jewish. Both of them were Jewish. We didn't do anything Jewish other than be very interested in honoring our minds and our ability to grow and think. And my father was extraordinary in that way, even though he came from Morocco and a Mediterranean culture, he didn't discriminate against women in any way. And he thought I was way too emotional compared to my brother, but I mean, he still had that, but there was never, you aren't as smart or as intellectually right. capable, or there was no sexism that way. Mm. So we were always encouraged to read and, you know, draw and paint and be engaged. And both my parents supported that.
Mm. Anything you want to say in response, Helen?
Well, I don't, you know, maybe in part two, we're going to get into this, but when I revisited, I'm trying to remember when I, the whole thing, Nicole, where that, Nicole would light a yard site candle.
So that's what started. I do want to say that. So my yeah. relationship with Judaism and with spiritual practice has grown. And I'm not a rabbi because I've had children and done other things and have not been able to do the career child thing. But I'm a tefillah leader, which means prayer leader at my congregation. And I lead women and men in ritual, and I lead services, and I prepare people for burial according to Jewish tradition. I mean, I actually wash bodies and help get, and I've been doing that for years. And I felt that there was this gap, and I knew every May 16th that my mother and my father were very sad and that they something needed to be acknowledged. And we have something in the Jewish tradition, which is a yard site, which is when you light a candle on the day, on the anniversary of the death. And I knew that nothing had been done for my sister when she died, anything traditional or Jewish. It was a very, very awful, terrible thing. They didn't even get to really have a traditional funeral or anything like that. Mm. So I asked my mom, and I told my mom and my dad that I was going to get a group of 10 people together where I lived and do what's get a minyan, which is 10 Jewish people, and say the prayers that you would normally say. And this is 30 on the 30th anniversary of my sister's death. So when I was 30 and so, or 31, or I'm not sure exactly when, but it was some anniversary that was significant. And that stimulated some stuff. And then my mom can talk about how that started to change things for her.
Well, I was drawing hands, I think, at the time I'd begun getting things with aging and particularly studying my aging hands. And I think it was postmenopausal or very, very close, or, you know, I don't have the timeline. I'll get it for you next time. But so I looked at my hand and then I visualized like, where is she now? And she was part of my hand. So she was
a little Paula hand.
Yeah. And then I started to do a whole series with that. And then I began lighting the candle. So again, it was my artwork and Nicole that kind of led me through that door. And later by random, I happened to go into a, what do we call it, Liberty Station here. It was a transformed naval base that became an art center and a whole complex of different things, offices, different nonprofits were in there. And I just was looking to see, well, what's here? Because it wasn't too far from where I lived. I was on a second floor and there was something that said the Jenna Druck Foundation, something to do with children and for child loss, or, you know, there were no groups, there were no things, there were no supports at that time. There's a world of things now, but there weren't then. And the person who had put it together happened to be sitting in his office or something. I don't know, somehow we got in a conversation. And he gave me one of his discs to listen to or something. And suddenly there was a world that opened up. I started coming to some of his programs. I started doing the training. And I actually started doing the specifically the mother's group. There was a group for moms.
Who had lost children.
Yeah. And the leader was an incredible woman. And I kept with my models of support for women. I felt like, oh my God, she's doing this. She needs support. You know, there need, I had learned that. I didn't want to lead a group or do, I never wanted to do that, but sometimes I did, but you know, if she couldn't, but so I began using some of my yoga stuff just to help people to breathe as we came into the room. But I, as I heard story after story and was helping or there to help them, really, I realized I was there to help myself as well as them. I think I faced things that I had never faced before. I still work with them. It's grief is something that has waves. You know, it re-triggers at times, but I'm much more at peace with it. And sometimes it's been so long for me too. I realized there were some people in the group said, well, this happened to me older, or my grown child, or I won't even live long enough to come to a place of resolve like you have or something. And, you know, I felt I could feel all the different range of when you, no matter what point you lose someone, including there were groups too, where people were the cats or the dogs or the, you know, loss. And now I understand more too about infertility and miscarriage. And, you know, there's such a range of it that gets spoken about. And there never is a place in the conversation to tell someone. I was thinking the other question when you went to, and one of them in some previous thing was, how many children do you have? We used to talk about that in the group. What do you say to everybody when that's a simple question?
But it's painful when it's on the medical form, you know, because it's there every time you go into the doctor.
Oh, yeah.
As a woman, how many children, how many live births, how many, you know, like these are things that come up. And I just want to say one other thing too about the grief as a process, like that it isn't something that is discrete and just happens once. It's something that goes on over time, and there's healing. We say tikkun, which means a repair or amending, that can happen all the time. There's potential, doesn't mean it fixes it, but there's healing that happens. And even in my mother's home in San Diego, my mom and my stepfather's home, my mom had built a sort of, I don't even know what to call it, alcove, a little Paula area that she had an artist friend do with.
In San Diego, because there wasn't a soul that even knew that I had lost a child in San Diego.
So she had this thing built. She could, you know, and butterflies hanging in it, and we decorated it. And it's like a little, and there's a little place you can sit in. It's sort of like a space for Paula out, you know, in the home, even though she's not, it's been many, many years. I mean, I'm 57 years. Am I 57 years old?
I think I'm 57. We probably get it wrong.
I'm very bad with numbers, but not with everything. Other things I'm good with, colors and patterns, not so much numbers. Same for my mom. But it's been 57 years, and we still have a place for Paula. You know, not just in my mother's art, but even continuing to make things happen. So that's part of, you know, for women, whether they've miscarried or they've lost a child or somebody close to them, that can always be part of your life, you know, in a healing, helpful way.
I lost my grandmother, who I was very, very close to, about a year and a half ago. And only recently through therapy, which I am new to, have learned that you have to create space for your grief. And space is the word that I've chosen for myself in 2022. And it is so much connected to this idea of, I have filled my life up. And you know, to 100%. And so when these feelings come up, right, they come out as anger, or they come out as a frustration, or, you know, I'm misguiding it. And it's because I have not created space in my life to process this grief. Like, I have not looked at her picture and taken 5 minutes and lit a candle. And I love, Nicole, that you know, at this point in my life, I don't really consider myself a religious person, but I know that the traditions of Judaism in particular allow for space for grief. You know, that's one of the big gifts of Judaism and a lot of religion in general. But I think Judaism in particular has just some really special connections to processing grief. Mm-hmm.
We know death, but you don't have to be Jewish to create space for for your grieving. And the ritual, it's a spiritual technology, just like my mother is you know, got a technology or an art that mm-hmm. she's developed with contour and with color and with mm-hmm. her skill set. You know, all traditions have some kind of spiritual technology that you can key into that's helpful. And and art is part of that. Mm-hmm. Art is absolutely part of that. You know, whether it's drawing or coloring or photographs or altars, Cinco de Mayo, you know, mm-hmm. not Cinco de Mayo, Dia de los Muertos, you know.
Well, you mentioned ways. The butterflies and.
Yeah. The mariposas.
Mariposas.
So those are all over the structure. I don't even know what we're calling it. Arbor structure.
An altar almost.
Well, it's a cave. It's not, it's actually kind of big. It's, it's sort of a structure in
it's
the backyard.
A set of branches of tree branches that form like an arc, but they're mm-hmm. open so that a child could like crawl in and then the wall behind it is where I began painting all the butterflies, but then there were 3D butterflies that are on the piece itself and all different. And last year I started with a friend, every once in a while somebody comes and helps me and it's wonderful. She noticed these the plastic palettes I make from, what do you call it, the food containers. I'm always using those as small palettes or something. So they're full of colors. Things have dried up. I haven't gotten back out there to finish it. And so they're very colorful. And she got the idea to just put them up. I'm going to try and send you a picture of some of this so you see it. So they're flipping around in the breeze right now. And anyway, I think we're probably running out of time.
I could just talk forever. Let's close with one more question. And I feel like a lot of this is connected just because, you know, everything that we're referencing now, you know, these different things that you've gone through in your life is all a point of connection to your body, Helen, right? You as the maternal body who carried these children, who gave birth to these children, who held your dying child in your arms, who, you know, I think of the maternal body and specifically your experience of the maternal body as, you know, just holding so much meaning. And so just wanting to hear both of you reflect a little bit about Helen, you being an artist who depicts your own body in your work and the bodies of your children in your work. You know, I would love for both of you to just to kind of reflect on that and maybe what, I don't know, what you feel like it's kind of taught both of you, like going through these stages of your life, thinking about the female body and the female body being depicted in art and the pregnant female body being depicted in art. Who wants to start?
So I'll just start and give my mom a little respite and then she can close however she wants to. But one of the things that I think has been really formative for me and really rare and unique is that there was never any shame in my house about the human body, the female body, the body period. I mean, my father was also, you know, from Morocco and Mediterranean and nudity was just like, nobody cared. Everybody, there was a lot of, you know, but it wasn't inappropriate. It was just like the body is beautiful. Mm-hmm. The body is normal. The body's part of us. It's not something to be shrouded. You know, it's just something. And my mother was painting herself pregnant and her breasts and her vagina. And those were around. I had those to see. And then, you know, there were nudes and then there were people sort of semi-dressed or partially dressed. And then there was paintings of me and pictures of me and photographs of me and my brother. And of us as babies naked and as young children naked. And then, you know, later when maybe we were a little bit more self-conscious, we had clothes on, but then there were pictures of me, you know, there's one of me when I'm like 18 or something. And I wrote a poem about being a woman. And so my mother did this sideways view of me, you know, a profile of me naked. And then I wrote the poem about being a woman, a young woman, and being beautiful. And, you know, so there was always this, there was just always this acceptance of the body for both my brother and I. And he was going through all kinds of changes in sexuality issues and my sexuality, and all those things were sort of present in the portraits. Mm-hmm. And when I look back at them, it's way better than a photograph because it's got like all this stuff in it. And if you look at, you know, when you go on the website, you'll see my mom's art and you can see some of these, because the series, if you go to, you know, Nicole or Paul, you'll see this progression of who we are. And then when I was pregnant with my kids, you know, my mother was painting them, and it was also a way for her to process her grief around my being a single mother and not having support. And again, she was painting me with my daughter, or she was painting me pregnant, even though that was very painful because I wasn't going to have the support and the help that, you know, and I wasn't like a happy situation per se, but there was still a place for joy to unfold. So I think that that's, what I want to say, and if there's more, mom can add to it, but that was really different and important. And that's a testament to my mother, for being an extraordinarily present with who we were and are, not focused on what should be or what would be, but actually what was going on. What did we look like? What were we feeling? What was our body doing? And no judgment about that. Just like, this is what Nicole's body looks like. These are the clothes she's wearing. This is the situation she's in. This is what her breasts look like. They have veins in them when they're nursing. Big boobs. You know, there's a portrait of me with these gigantic, you know, deep magenta. It's a deep, dark fuchsia magenta colored portrait. And, you know, giant nipples with these blue veins. And then there's little pictures that my kids have painted on there, you know, like a little sunshine that my daughter drew or a flower. I think Isaac did the sunshine, you know, my 3-year-old Isaac, who's now about to be 37, 36, 34. I'm so bad with numbers. he's going to be 35 or 34. And my other, yeah. So, but has a 3-year-old, you know, he made a little sun, and my daughter as a 6-year-old did this little flower curling around my boob. I mean, who has that? It's just not
many people.
And my children got that, right? They also got that.
Amazing. Thanks, Nicole. Helen, anything you want to share?
Something about how we as women know change within the whole evolution, right?
Yeah.
The continual change of what goes on, you know, from menstruating to pregnancy to menopause to, you know, and now old, watching the things that the body does. There's a rhythm or an understanding that emanates from our bodies that puts us in touch with all the cycles of the earth and connects us to things beyond our body. And mothering really fits into this enormously for me, for those experiences. And even though we may be equal about what we can do or you know, the skills or the this or the that, we are biologically quite different. And there's strong calls coming from that. You know, I don't really have something to say about it. I haven't.
What a gift that you gave your daughter and your son, like a son seeing, you know, his mother's naked body depicted over and over in art. Like it also, you know, like there's just so much there to think about and so much for us to be aware of. And Nicole, I just love the call to the present, right? Mm-hmm. Like not the comparison, not the somebody else, but just the me here now, and this is who I am. I'm your child, and this is my body, and let's experience joy and pleasure and pain and just do life together. I don't know. Just it's okay.
My God.
We did it. We did part one. Friends, please, while you are enjoying this episode, head to Helen's websites. She has two of them. I'm going to read those for you now. You can go to helenredmond.com and birthingthecrone.com to check out more of her work. And in part two, which is going to be published next week, we're going to be sharing more about sort of the later stages of Helen's career and her life and some of the big things that have happened to her career recently. So I'm excited to share. You know, today was kind of a look back, and of course, all of this is cyclical and all connected, but now we're going to talk a little bit more about the contemporary work that you're making, Helen, in part two. So, Nicole, Helen, just filled with gratitude. Thank you so much.
The Artist Mother podcast is curated and produced by Kaylin Butine. Music by Josh Middleton. Editing and mixing by John M. Butine. Please visit www.artistmotherpodcast.com for episode notes and to find out how you can further support this podcast.